now treasuries are like directly get like this whole thing about Fed independence or central bank, it's all out the window because they're just working directly. Like treasury has a huge account, it gets the money in reserve form from the Fed. It's an, now the treasury has an asset. They also issued their bonds directly to the Fed as a liability for them. But then how does that money leak out in the economy? It leaks out in the form of those stimulus checks. And they're going, there's no reserve ratio on them. So they're going, so they have to be not hyperinflation, but they, by definition, they have to be inflationary because there's just nothing backing them on the other side except for some demand for government bonds, but they're not even out in the market. I mean, the Fed is buying it directly from the Treasury. It seems that the growth of such an asset requires an exponential sort of boom because of a variety of factors, and that seems what it does. Do I think that it will blow past like gold in one run? Probably, you know, absolutely not. But I do think, you know, if you see it blow past 20,000 and then go to like 100,000, maybe 200,000, certainly could do that. It's still going to be below the top four currencies. Is that at that number? I don't know. Who knows? I mean, maybe it blows up to 250, 300 in the next run, and then I put that actually in the notes. Is that I think as that is that multiplier? The notes of my table as that multiplier goes towards one of basically the you know, the value of Bitcoin instead of being like 99x smaller than fiat, but if it goes to basically one, I don't see why we wouldn't at least start to have other people understand things in the unit of Satoshi or the unit of a BTC for sure. I think that's a great point. And I think that has to happen in the next 10 years, but these are glacial things. These definitely are slow. I think that has to happen.
Hey, how are you all doing? My name is Kayvon Devani. I'm the host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show and the Total Connector Show, together with my co-moderator, Stephanie von Jahn, economist, Austrian economist, Bitcoiner, amazing author. We're going to talk to Matthew Mesinskis of Crypto Voices. He's an extraordinary, fascinating analyst, and which breaks down things in very crystal clear language. We're going to talk about money, and of course, Bitcoin. We're talking, of course, you know, certainly we're going to talk about gold, silver, governmental fiat money, and all that, you know, compared with Bitcoin's 21 million, absolute scarcity versus relative scarcity of gold. We're going to talk about, you know, Bitcoin as unit of account, the FOMO that's been kicking in on a lot of levels, institutional, individual, corporate, governmental, or even central banking level. So it's going to be a really exciting fight. I'm really looking forward to that. So without further ado, this is our talk with Matthew Mesinskis together with Stephanie von Jahn. Hope you're going to enjoy this. Let me know what you think afterwards. Let me know your questions. And please, if you loved it as much as I did, please give it a like, share, subscribe, please, to my YouTube channel and to my podcast platforms. Thank you so much. I'll see you soon again.
All right, welcome to the show. My two special guests is Matthew Mesinskis from Crypto Voices and Stephanie von Jahn. She's an economist and lectures on Austrian economics, writes excellent articles. Matthew, would you just for our listeners, because you've been on my show, but maybe a short introduction, give a short introduction about yourself?
Sure. Guten Tag to you both. Nice to meet you, Stephanie. I haven't mentioned before. Yes, as Kayvon mentioned, been on the show, I guess once or twice before. I host a podcast primarily focused on economics and money and Bitcoin called Crypto Voices. And also I put out this quarterly release on the global monetary base, which is at the moment it's growing, but at the moment it's a collection of the top 30 floating fiat currencies, looking at their monetary base and see how fast it grows and comparing that with Bitcoin. So as far as mostly things to do with the Bitcoin world or crypto world or even sort of public facing economics that I do, that's mostly it.
Awesome. So Stephanie, you have your own like very, very excellent questions already prepared, and you've written a really excellent a Twitter thread on, you know, on this relationship of, you know, Bitcoin, gold, silver, base money, And there's just some points that I would like to emphasize or which stand out for me for the, you know, the Joe and Mary from the streets. For example, there are some like facts that you've written about, for example, that the that because it's always, you know, it's always mentioned that the central banks have been buying like hundreds of tons of gold in the last months and years. And what I wasn't aware of really is that, for example, that the central banks nowadays have actually much less, substantially less gold reserves than in the year, I think was 1965, right? Maybe you can elaborate. I have a couple of other questions, but maybe we can start off with gold just to, you know, have it a check marked. Like how much gold is there really? And considering now that they've found, I think it Polius, the corporation Polius in Russia have found the biggest gold reserves in Subutlok in Siberia, I think approximately 60 million ounces. So, you know, it's this interesting thing of relative scarcity and absolute scarcity. I want to know, like, what kind of implications does this have if just, you know, the initial findings in Siberia on, you know, on the relative scarcity and the stock to flow ratio, maybe, and the, you know, sort of unknown or relative unknown scarcity, or also a difficult auditability of gold. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's lots to say on gold and Bitcoin and silver as always, but my sort of interest, or what I like to try to do, is really just try to kind of lay the landscape before really even making predictions or making sort of broad implications of what that might mean. I do make a few of them, but yeah, there's a few interesting things regarding gold on a relative basis and on an absolute basis, as you mentioned. First of all, so right now there's about one. I like to think in ounces because it's price per ounce, and usually the gold industry doesn't do that for some reason. They record in metric tons, but there's about 1.1 billion ounces of gold in central banks, if we believe them. And that's another thing, because of course the World Gold Council, GATA, there's a lot of people that have researched the possibility that central banks have actually, they hold gold as sort of a superposition, like a Schrodinger's cat, of two simultaneously things on their books, which cannot happen. One is that it's an asset, like it sits in a vault, and the other is it's a receivable, which they have lent out to the market, presumably to keep the price down over the long term. You know, Bill Murphy from GATA has done a lot of work on that. There's a lot of people that have done a lot of work on that. I don't know, I cannot say for sure if that's true or not. You know, the United States gold supply has not changed much at all in the last 30, 40 years. It's never been audited, as we know. So we kind of just take it on faith or face value that it is what they say that it is. But it's roughly 1/6 of all the gold that's ever been mined is supposedly in central banks. So it's about 6 billion ounces, and 1.1 billion ounces is in the coffers of central banks as an asset. Now, the interesting thing is that in the 60s and the 70s, when famously Charles de Gaulle was claiming his gold from the U.S., which was the last sort of thing that you could do with a tie from real money, gold being, you know, to fiduciary media, which is basically the tickets that a bank or a government can issue. The last sort of claim that you could ever do ended, as most gold bugs know and Bitcoin bugs know, in 1971. That was a primarily result of, you know, the U.S. spending the Vietnam War and Charles de Gaulle claiming that gold back from the U.S. And the U.S. eventually just said, no, okay, we're not gonna redeem anymore. You can't redeem gold. So interestingly, that you know, the world didn't collapse. Markets went on. They adjusted, adapted, and as you mentioned, that was actually the peak, at least officially and presumably still, in gold holdings of central banks, was in about the 60s, mid 60s. I can't think of that number off the top of my head, but that was the peak. And now it's a little bit down at 1.1 billion ounces. It's way down as a proportion of the monetary base, though. So there's that slide. You know, eventually I'll start to do articles on this. Now it's just tweets, but it's tweet 16 that you mentioned, where you see in like the 70s and the 80s, the monetary base, which is a the ultimate asset of settlement. Like it, that is when people say printing money, that is what they mean. It's the central bank printing press. It's physical cash and currency, and also bank reserves together. Right now, it's about $25 trillion, which you see, that's the green on that chart. Very small on the left, very big on the right. Gold, you will see as a percentage, and this is only the top 30, by the way, so it's sort of apples to apples, because it's only looking at the top 30 floating currencies. But gold, you will see as a percentage of that, was much, much higher in the 70s and the 80s, close to around 80%. Compared to now, it's, you know, it's down to 5-7%, and that's very interesting because it shows that the market, central banks can get away with printing money, and the market, you know, for some time believes in them. For how much longer, you know, no one really knows, but for some time, they are getting away with basically printing money and having like basically no gold behind it. Now, of course, gold is not money. Now, legally, you cannot redeem it. There's no connection, but they still hold gold. And I always think about that famous exchange that Ron Paul had with Ben Bernanke, you know, like, well, why do central banks hold gold? And Ben Bernanke responded like, oh, it's just tradition. It's just tradition. So they try to tell you that it's not money. It's not real value or anything. They try to tell you that, but of course they still hold it. And again, we don't even know how much they have, but yeah, it's just one perspective. Again, it's interesting that back in, you know, the very hyperinflationary days of the 70s, gold was a bigger, much bigger percentage of central banks' balance sheets than now. Now it's, you know, less than 10%. So yeah, I can stop there. I don't know if Stephanie wants to say anything or any other.
Yeah, I think Stephanie's questions tie in pretty good because we also have some questions about the, like, I don't know what to call it. Like Stephanie's like compound rate growth or something like that. And first of all, let me just clarify. So the inflation rate of gold is approximately has been like 1.8%, like 2% per year.
Yeah, 1.8 is pretty much the number. 1.8% over about 200 years.
All right. Do you think, Matthew, it's realistic? I mean, you know, finding more gold reserves, you know, having more like whatever better mining technologies, that this inflation rate could, you know, if the demand especially, you know, increases, that eventually it goes beyond, way beyond the 2% in the foreseeable future. You know,
well, I mean, the example that the Winklevoss twins are famously using these days is, you know, and pointing out, which is absolutely true, is that, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, everybody wants to start mining asteroids. That's a double-edged sword. That could work for certain things. But if we're thinking about preserving wealth, I mean, there's trillions and trillions of gold and silver in these asteroids that they want to mine. And if that comes down to Earth, that would absolutely collapse the price, which would be interesting to see. But you never know. I mean, it's a function of supply and demand. Gold bugs, you know, traditional Austrian economist Murray Rothbard famously as well, had a very big soft spot for gold because of that. But at the end of the day, this is a key difference between gold and Bitcoin, is because Bitcoin, we know there's only 21 million units. That is unlike fiat, which we point out in the monetary base update, but it's even unlike gold and silver because, you know, even though we know that, like, yeah, fixed in the Earth's crusts over billions of years, there is a fixed amount of gold and silver now today, although there is some in outer space and asteroids. Let's just ignore outer space now. Even though it's fixed in the Earth's crust, it always increases. Like it always increases. It has happened to be a predictable rate of about 1.8% over the last 200 years, but it always increases. So that's something that's very different than even Bitcoin. But not even Bitcoin. Right, it's very different than Bitcoin.
I remember even Eric Buskowitz saying, you know, it wouldn't be that difficult to replicate or, you know, alchemistically, you know, like reproduce gold in a whatever way, nuclear, you know, plasmatic or whatever technology. But, you know, I mean, we haven't really discovered or found or really went into the bottom of the oceans.
It could be a Comstock load again. Absolutely, these reserves, as you mentioned, in Russia, and it has been done alchemically. As I understand, I am not an expert on this. I actually mentioned it in my interview with Adam Back, and he confirmed, and I've read it. I mean, you might have read it too in passing. Like,
yeah,
it's extremely expensive, but it is possible to synthesize gold.
Yeah.
So that's another thing.
You know, Matthew, the reason I'm like talking so much now about gold is because I'm very confident that one day in the very foreseeable future, gold is just going to be reduced to its utility function, whatever, for you industrial technological purposes. And then, because you're saying in your Twitter thread that Bitcoin may become, you know, the global base money. So, but what are the conditions for that? Or what are the required necessary conditions? So, okay. But Stephanie, go ahead with your questions and we can, you know, I can just.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was very enlightening. I really liked your report. I could also learn quite some things. So I don't have questions on gold in particular, but one thing that I wanted to make clear, I wasn't aware so much about this compound return approach, but as far as I understand, you were also mentioning it in tweet 62, you explained a little bit more on what you're doing. So you said that you are averaging things, averaging the changes in the money supply within a month, and then you average all these months together within a year, and this is then what you're using as the compound changes per year. Is this correct?
Correct. And you can compound any rate of return, right? So you could take a daily rate, you could take a monthly rate, you could take a quarterly rate. And if you just the formula is very simple, you know, one plus that rate raised to how many months it takes you to get to a year. So 12 in the case of what I'm doing, minus one, that will give you the comp. That is the formula for compound return. That is different than if I were to do that, you know, that financial formula, that present value, future value, where you solve for the rate, that would be the more precise, exact way to do it. It is true. I've compared it just because I'm a bit like, you know, the dollar 50 years ago versus dollar today, the difference is a few basis points between my method, which, as you mentioned, it's taking all the months, averaging just the average month return, and then compounding that to annual, you know, taking it to the 12th exponent, finding a compound return that way. If you did it, the present value, future value, that's the financial function, the time value of money function, that would be like more precise. It's slightly different. The reason I do it that way though, however, is the reason I use the monthly compounding, as I mentioned, it's primarily for the two currencies, and I hope to add more, which is going to happen more often. But the two biggest currencies in this exhibit are the currencies of Argentina and the currencies of Brazil. And in order to find a long-term compound growth rate of those using the traditional financial functions of present value, future value, solve for the rate of growth, it's actually impossible because a cruzado or a new cruzado or whatever, Brazil had like six currencies, Argentina had five different currencies. If I would take that unit in their monetary base in like in the 70s or in the 80s and compare it to the real or the Argentinian peso today, it would be impossible because they're two different units. So that's why I've settled on this monthly growth rate. And then in those cases of those currencies where the currency was just devalued, reset, zeros slashed, I just ignore that month. And you'll see it. Like if you actually look at the balance sheets of Brazil or Argentina, they do report their hyperinflations. Like I talk with Max Hillebrand about this a lot. It's one of the things I want to try to find is the actual money supply of the Weimar Republic. Maybe you guys can help out with this as well. You know, you can find lots of charts about the hyperinflation in Weimar of prices, right? But you can't find, at least I haven't found, the actual growth in the money stock. That's what I'm very curious about. And I imagine it's in South Deutsch. I don't think anyone has brought it to the English world. So if you guys can help with that, please let me know. But the point is measuring the actual units. So it's not measuring like how much a peso was worth 10 years ago in dollars versus now or anything. Like it's definitely just very consistent approach of units upon units upon units, how many are created. And the most precise, accurate way would be to use that present value, future value function and solve for the rate. But you just can't do that across all currencies. And so that's why I use this monthly compounding. And it's very close. I mean, there is a discrepancy, but I've checked it with the big ones like the dollar, the euro over 20 years. The euro has got some notes too, as we know, euro only started in 1999. I can explain if you want, but the discrepancy is small. But yes, I'm taking the monthly growth, raising it to the 12th exponent, subtract one, and that will give you a compounded annualized figure, which is that figure that you can derive doubling time from. You can, that's the figure that would compare to a government yield. It would compare to GDP growth. Like, yeah, you always want to try to find compound growth. And I think a lot of people struggle with that, even economists, because they just sort of think in terms of like annual growth or like, you know, like what's the latest year's growth of GDP. But if you want to look over like 10 years or 30 years or 50 years and find a rate that is comparable, that will allow you to compare what happened with other things across that time, that is that compound growth figure. So I try to push people a lot, yeah, to look at compound growth instead of just like, you know, gross, like what's the, you know, the amount of dollars is 50 times higher than it was in, you know, 1980. Like that's less helpful because we use compound growth. And the interest rate itself is a statement of compounding. That is a compounded figure. So when you hear like, you know, a 5% interest for a mortgage or IRR, internal rate of return, all these figures are rates of compounding, as Thomas Jefferson, I think, said was the eighth wonder of the world. So it is important. Yeah,
great, thank you so much. Now it's much clearer. You really differentiated between increases in the money supply and the increases in prices, and this was so well how you did this, because so many people, when they analyze changes in the purchasing power, they're looking at how to prices change, but you were turning this whole thing around, merely looking how the money supply changed. And here it really makes sense to also use these compounding to measure different currencies across time and to cancel out also the hyperinflation. So this is very, very fascinating. I actually don't know anyone else who does it like in this strict way. So it's really mind blowing. Really cool.
Thank you, Sean. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I have one more question. In tweet 6, you also noted that the actual money supply are the notes, the bank notes, and the reserves, and that's it. And all the M1, M2, M3 are claims on that. And I think this was also a very nice way on how to look at it. I was writing an article where I made a balance sheet analysis and had a look on how money was created. And I found that the biggest entries on the liability side of the balance sheet are indeed the banknotes and the reserves, but they also have some other entries in there, like other liabilities, so which I would not count to the monetary base then. But like as far as I remember, like 80% of the whole balance sheet value was captured by the notes and the reserves. So this is, it's kind of, when you look at the balance sheet value, this is kind of an estimate on the monetary base. But, you know, of course, you would need to have a closer look in this. And this is what I want to ask you. Mm-hmm. Did you check out different central banks, if it's like always the case that this monetary base is the majority of the balance sheet?
Yeah, I haven't done a detailed analysis of that proportion. But in principle, the answer is yes, and that's coming. It's a lot of data. I'm trying to formulate and publish, and maybe even have much more on the website in the future. But yes, that is like the source of all the money now, and really quickly as well, so people can understand, that is the, as you mentioned, it's a liability on the central bank's balance sheet. So it may be confusing, right? Like, it's the money, but why is it a liability? And the reason for that, hopefully I can do this very quick explanation, is as we talked about gold and silver, today's basic money, which has no connection to gold and silver, but today's basic money was yesterday's fiduciary media. And fiduciary media is always a liability for the one that creates it. So what is fiduciary media? That is the tickets, claims, checks, bankers' notes that that the market creates by, you know, private interactions with individuals. That's fiduciary media. But so it was even with government notes before, certainly before 1971, well, kind of, as we know, because only central banks could make the claim, could redeem, but certainly before 1935 and into the 1800s. If you had, and you obviously, you probably know a lot of economists show pictures of old notes where you can redeem for this amount of gold or silver. But if you took in that note, that ticket to the central bank or to any bank, you could redeem in specie, you could redeem in real money, which was gold and silver. And so that's where that accounting relationship, that's hopefully you see what I'm getting at. That's where it starts to make sense. It's like the real money has always been an asset. And by the way, Bitcoin is an asset too. So gold, silver, it always sits as an asset on the bank's books or the central bank's books. But if you, as the holder of that ticket, which can circulate as money, you want to redeem it for real money, then you go and you can do that. But from the perspective of the issuer, from the perspective of the bank, the central bank, that ticket is always a liability because they got to have on reserve the real money. So that's how that works on the balance sheet. That's why it's always found on the liability side, which I think you mentioned, you know, Stephanie, that's like, it's important to point out, like, because it's confusing for a lot of people, like, why is base money a liability for a central bank? Why it's not an asset? It's just because today's basic money was yesterday's fiduciary media. Like, that's just how it's worked in the past, is that those tickets really could be redeemed for gold, but now you can't redeem them for anything. Now it's just government bonds that are on the other side, the asset side of their balance sheet. So it's a long-winded answer there. I still wanted to say, though, there's one more item which maybe you had seen or thought about, is the way that helicopter money, which we're now seeing in the real world, the way that that can get out into the economy is via the Treasury. And the Treasury does have an account with the central bank as well. I don't know if you've noticed that as well. It's with like the Federal Reserve. It's huge now. It's over $1 trillion. Some people are calling that base money, but that's actually it's erroneous, because that money is not in the banking system. So the reason that the reserves and the currency are base money, those two portions, is because they are literally in the banking system. Like, they circulate legally. They're legal tender for debts. A bank can issue credit with reserving some of those, that money. So those are reserve. Those are all the reserve, the bank reserves and the physical currency. They're always and everywhere in the banking system. They're in the financial system. That's why they're basement, and they're the top of it. They're literally like, no bank can settle with another bank without doing some sort of a settlement with bank reserves. So that's that. Now there is this other thing that's happening, which used to be very small and used to be inconsequential, which is Treasury accounts with their central bank are growing. And you can see that it's called the TGA with the Fed, the Treasury General Account. I'm not sure the latest, it's over $1 trillion now. You know, where the monetary base is around $5 trillion of the United States dollar, for example. The Treasury account now is about $1 trillion. And that is getting very close to hyperinflation helicopter money style. But basically, I'll try to do that. I wasn't sort of thinking I would talk about this. So I'll try to do it in a simple way. I think it's happening. And it's happening every day. It's been happening since March. Is the Treasury normally would issue bonds and they just sell it to banks. Fed's not even involved. Central banks is not involved. It's a primary auction market. They're just issuing bonds. Banks are buying it. Pension funds buying it, whatever. If the Fed wants to get involved, wants to set the discount rate, everything, it comes into the secondary market, which is the repo market, as we know, or the open market operations. That's when they manipulate the money supply. That's when they buy or sell. They're buying like literally from the open market, from the banks. They're not buying from the Treasury. Now that things are so severe and so serious, they are buying directly from the Treasury. They're taking the bonds, they're giving the Treasury money. And that's a huge liability now, that printed money in their account. They're just doing it directly. And then how does that money get into the money supply? Well, that gets in, I don't have a curtain. It's sunny here, but thankfully at least it's sunny. It's good to have some sunny days in these crazy times. But so you might be wondering, okay, that's happening. This Treasury general account is growing on the central bank balance sheet, but it doesn't actually get into the money supply until the Treasury starts paying for stuff. So the government, as we all know, doesn't do anything in more ways than one. It doesn't do anything, but the only way that the government really can like intervene in the markets, or whatever, is by paying for stuff. So when the Treasury issues bonds, it's paying for stuff. But when it issues bonds and it gets that money directly from the Fed, which is that Treasury general account, and then it starts to pay for stuff. Like think about stimulus checks. And I don't even know it goes in, like, I don't know if helicopter money has fully happened in Europe now that I think of it. I know that there are these COVID bonds, but I think, have we gotten stimulus checks in Europe theoretically? I mean, I wouldn't get them, but I don't
know. No, that would be like unconditional, like universal basic income.
Crediting your account, basically. A credit. Yeah, I don't think it has happened yet. But that's like they're literally in the U.S. now. There are checks that are going out signed by the treasurer and people. So that was directly money that just came from the Fed, like direct. And that's that Treasury general account, which is now huge, Stefan. It's to your point, it's growing. It's another big liability portion. So that is the step when it gets into the money supply. And once people deposit those checks, and this happens as well when the Fed or when the Treasury just pays for services, they start depositing those checks. Then it gets into accounts, broad money grows, and the money supply increases. That's why you see M1 now growing much faster than it did over like 2008, when only the monetary base was growing faster. And you might be wondering, well, if all this money is growing on the broader money, right? Like you deposit the money, what about the basic money? What about those reserve ratios now are out of whack? Because the reserve ratios for big banks used to be 10%, mid banks was 3.5%. And actually small banks in the US never had any reserve ratio. Well, since March, there's no reserve ratio. They have, they have stopped it. There is no reserve ratio at all. And I'm not saying that the Fed knows what the reserve ratio should be. Like they definitely don't. And I'm not also a fan of 100% reserve ratios. Like I don't think it needs to be 100%. But it's gone. There is no reserve ratio at all. So that helicopter money that's slowly sent out stimulus checks to the economy, That was directly created from the Fed, but it goes in a bit different way than it typically goes with central bank reserves and with just regular currency going into the economy. So I hope I didn't lose you there. I myself was kind of going on something I was not planned to really say, but it goes to what you were saying, Stephanie, about the liability side of the balance sheet. It is those two things typically, just the bank reserves and the currency. Now treasuries are like directly get like this whole thing about Fed independence or central bank, it's all out the window because they're just working directly. Like treasury has a huge account. It gets the money in reserve form from the Fed. Now the treasury has an asset. They also issued their bonds directly to the Fed as a liability for them. But then how does that money leak out in the economy? It leaks out in the form of those stimulus checks. Mm-hmm. And, there's no reserve ratio on them. So they're going. They have to be hyperinflation, but they, by definition, they have to be inflationary because there's just nothing backing them on the other side, except for some demand for government bonds, but they're not even out in the market. I mean, the Fed is buying it directly from the Treasury. I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, so I had a look in the annual report of last year, and there the account of the Treasury was less than 1/4. So it was 1/4 around in regards to the reserves. So let's say it's 1/4 that was the Treasury and 3/4 was the reserves, but it was actually even more than 3/4 the reserves. But now, as you say that, this ratio will probably change quite tremendously. So that's very interesting to have a look at it. I also just checked that I found in the annual report of 2019 that Federal Reserve notes are obligations of the United States governments. So this is also something that changed completely. Before that, it was pegged to gold, but now it's an obligation of the United States government. And how does the United States government get their revenue from if it's not money out of thin air? They get it through tax. So essentially, the Federal Reserve notes are backed through future tax payments. And so this whole dynamic has changed completely on what is a Federal Reserve note and what is backed. So this whole government structure is actually behind this whole thing. Yeah, it's just went more and more crazy.
Not stopping. It really is not stopping.
Yeah, let me go back to this original question I had. And as you mentioned in your Twitter thread, Matthew, you said that Bitcoin might become or may become the global reserve-based money. Now, if we zoom out a little bit, and I don't know, maybe these points I'm going to mention is might be irrelevant for our discussion. But as you've heard, like Iran has put out a decree or law that says, you know, the central bank or the national bank of Iran would literally like buy or determine at what price they would buy directly from the Bitcoin miners in Iran in order to circumvent the sanctions and to buy, you know, purchase the imports or pay for the imports. And, you know, the FOMO that's been now, you know, in high gear now on every individual level, institutional level, ultra net, you know, rich people. Does that play into, you know, this elaboration that you have, this you know, written out? Is that somehow relevant to our discussion?
We'll see. I think it does. I mean, certainly, I mean, Iran is surprisingly, I mean, a lot of people probably don't know, but I mean, it is a top 30 floating currency. And, it, you know, it's not that large as you could see if you look at that spectrum of the different base monies that I report on, those top 30, like really, you know, the top four or five are 90%, you know, the dollar, euro, yen, yuan, and pound. But, It is a huge currency relatively to the rest of the world, and Iran is one of these countries that has had to deal with sanctions like North Korea and others, and yeah, they're going to try to do what they can, I think, to get around it. I haven't seen it on the balance sheet yet. I'm mm-hmm. curious to see what it would look like on the balance sheet. Their balance sheet is very precise in English. I mean, they show it. The hardest thing about this, a side note, the hardest thing about Iran's balance sheet is it's in the Persian calendar. It's in this like Muslim, like it's in a Persian, it's the old Persian. It's not the Muslim calendar, I should say, but it's, I don't know precisely the difference.
Me neither. I'm not familiar, but and, yeah, it's something like, I don't even know what years would that be, but anyway. Yeah, like
1398 yeah. right now, uh-huh. but it's, so adjusting for that is actually kind of annoying, but it's interesting. There's a slight difference between the Persian and the maybe the regular Muslim calendar. But anyway, there's the Persian calendar, and they're very clear on what they report. I mean, they do it normally just like anybody else. I know that there are some special laws in those certain religions that have some restrictions on interest and things, but they do report it the same way. So I presume Bitcoin would be there on the left side, on the asset side of the balance sheet, even if they're printing money to buy it. It'd be interesting to see. It'd be interesting to see how that will grow. And Israel as well. I mean, you talk yeah. about politics, right? I mean, you have two nations that historically don't quite get along. It's very interesting to see that Bitcoin is a unifying factor
right.
Between the two of them, I think. So it's not a direct answer, I guess, to your question, but there's certainly some interesting things.
Yeah, because you said something about reserve assets. I mean, Iran, do you think the Iranian government or the National Bank of Iran like deliberately like wants to keep a low profile? They don't want to name it like it's a reserve asset. But what if, you know, it triggers sort of a competitive jurisdictional arbitrage, whatever you call it, like more governments, more national banks, you know, FOMO into this reserve asset FOMO, you know, like would do you see that coming? Like,
well, everybody's speculating that it's going to come some mm-hmm. at some time, you know, if it's a Caribbean bank or an Iranian, you know, Iranian bank or the Bank of Iran. Or, you know, North Korea, we know, has been mining for a long time. I mean, there's certain things that just are going to keep happening no matter what the, you know, the powers that be say. So yeah, I think it's really interesting. I certainly like tracking it and seeing the changes, but you know, it's like, and I've said this before, and I'm sure you guys have as well, like what happened with Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy and like, and even Square. I mean, I did not see that coming. I did not see this boost in a corporate treasury asset this year being Bitcoin. Certainly he's made the biggest splash, but there are others, not just Bitcoin companies. And that will absolutely continue. And the fact that it's happening both on the corporate level and now on the international level.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. But I don't know. I wonder what you guys think as well. I see in Europe more more regulatory hurdles as far as like a personal account with Bitcoin. You know, I've just on some chats and things that I'm in, you know, I've seen things where like a bank, might even be like Deutsche Bank, I can't remember, DB Nord. It was like they're starting again to, you know, I know in Germany now for a while, like for a year, it's been like Bitcoin banking or crypto banking is like law, right? I mean, you can do it. But I'm starting to see much more about the regulatory capture of like this stuff, like take a screenshot of your wallet or show, you know, very invasive on your personal privacy, that this is actually your coins and not the coins of someone else. So I don't know what you guys think about that. I see Europe as being very more,
especially much more Netherlands. I mean, isn't that like the, what is it called? Biotonic, something like that. They require, the Central Bank of Netherlands requires an exchange to, you know, to have its customers like prove or validate that it's really their wallet that they're using or something. I mean, it's really pretty like intrusive and yeah. So yeah. I don't know how it's going to evolve, you know, generally in the European Union.
Yeah. Yeah. Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah. So what I saw in the last weeks and months is that they are trying to make more and more regulation, less privacy, and also more tax on it, so that you always have to make a wealth tax or something. So these are things that are in discussion. But I mean, if you look at the incentive structure, it's quite obvious that the governments don't like Bitcoin. So, and I think there could be more to come, that they're trying with prohibitions, but they will not completely do this. I mean, you cannot prohibit that. It's the protocol, of course, you cannot. Mm-hmm. But it would make it more difficult to use it as a currency. So they can do something. I'm curious how far they go or whether they say, okay, now we adopt Bitcoin. I think it very much also depends on which country you're looking. So the smaller countries are more likely to rather adopt Bitcoin than to fight it and to make get an advantage of that. So, but we see how it turns out in the future. So I expect everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very mixed signals in the US too, although I do see much less invasive like personal intervening than I see in Europe. And I have kind of a foot in both waters, as you might know. I have my mixed parents, a Latvian and American, but the you know, like what happened in Wyoming giving a banking license to Kraken was amazing. And then two weeks later you have the Department of Financial Services in New York and the FBI and Department of Justice, like trying to, you know, throw criminal charges at the founders of BitMEX. Like those are two, you know, conflicting things in the course of 2 weeks. That's very, you know, okay. It's like, all right, we know we can't control this, but we're going to regulate the hell out of it. And yeah, if you're good, you're going to get a banking license. Like it's very, it's you know, and I'm all for Bitcoin privacy. Like I certainly want it to be there as much as it can on a protocol level, with being, you know, obviously there's all debates about that, about keeping the protocol like sound and safe. But I mean, yeah, it's mixed signals. And it's like with such uncertainty in the world, you know, I think like you said, Stephanie, I don't think it's going to stop. I think it will definitely, it's going to keep coming. And yeah, it's something to, I don't know how to like neatly summarize my last train of thought here, but it's kind of like, you know, there's a debate even in the Bitcoin world where you had relatively well-known Bitcoiners like Trace Mayer, who kind of was not really promoting coin mixing, but just promoting self-sovereignty, right? And then you have plenty of other Bitcoiners that are promoting the hell out of coin mixing and coin joins and you know, Lightning also is an anonymizer. Yeah. So, you know, I can see, and this is nothing new that I'm saying, like we know that this is a topic that has been coming, and it might even become some sort of a debate on the protocol level. I don't think it's there at all yet, but you know, this debate versus like, if it's just sovereign, like if you know that it's yours and you know that you can send it to a bank that's regulated, or if you truly can like have it be yours and then like, you know, gift it to your nephew or niece or whoever, you know, in a purely like self-sovereign liberty fashion, like you can't a gold coin really. That's really what they're coming after. And
what I actually realized when I went deeper into Bitcoin, that through Bitcoin, I realized the importance of privacy. And now I'm like all in for privacy. I'm paying everything in cash because I just don't want that my bank knows everything. Mm-hmm. Although yeah. I'm buying vegetables for that, so no, nothing big. But yeah, privacy has become more and more important. I'm also like trying to have my conversations like secure, end-to-end encrypted, even if it's just a random conversation. And also I'm using more privacy protecting browsers just as a principle. I don't like that.
Yeah, completely agree.
What do you think about the central bank digital currencies playing into this? I mean, this whole push of Lagarde, you know, the former criminally convicted president of the European Central Bank, pushing for the digital euro and central bank digital currencies.
And the UK has been researching it longer than anyone in China as well. It will be another form of base money. It would be, you know, it would be the third rail of basic money if they could pull it off. I've said this a long time. I'm still in the phase of my life where I'm doing a lot of research with numbers and I'm not writing too many articles. Maybe that will come at some point. But I have thought and I have said for a long time that, you know, I mean, like, we've seen that the government cannot like put together a healthcare like website without it getting, you know, hacked or problems. And I really do doubt the soundness of a central bank digital currency, not being a technologist myself. I really doubt the soundness of it. And like some hacker in just a place that doesn't even care about that, you know, say it's like a Caribbean country who's like hiring, you know, some third rate, you know, Joe to code it up. Doesn't really matter how much security you have. There's always going to be some actor. It could be a state actor. It could be someone who doesn't like you. That's going to come after it. So I really have a hard time seeing how they take off from like, I don't know, a kind of a sound technical level. Again, not being a technologist myself. What I do think they could do very much is to regulate the hell out of these stable coins, which are very, very successful. I mean, stable coins, even though, you know, you could be in Pluto and know that there's still some issues going on with Tether. I mean, from at least the soundness of like this relationship with Bitfinex, whatever. I'm not saying like take my money out of Tether or whatever, but like, you know, everybody's got to make their choice about, you know, Tether is clearly not base money like Bitcoin because there are dollars and bonds and some other assets, maybe a loan from Bitfinex that is backing the thing that is called the TUSD. But that is something that works. It's private. It's like a banking system within Bitcoin or within the world of crypto. And so I do think that those protocols, those projects, those coins, those institutions that surround them, they could very easily get, and as we've seen, like about a year ago, I guess it was about a year ago, there was another big injunction. I don't know, this request from the NYDFS to Bitfinex and Tether at all these people that are connected trying to get more information. You know, and Tether does well. I mean, Tether has gotten through the storm. I have no idea the state of like Bitfinex's vis-a-vis Tether's sort of soundness, but you know, those are, I'm fine with those, like individual market actors making those choices, but the governments will not be. They see a low-hanging fruit that they can take advantage of, they can regulate. And even though that is not base money, that would be, you know, some sort of just managing, it's like managing a bank, right? It's not, that's not base money that's in those stable coins. At least there's some circular economy that's circulating around with those that I think they would like to regulate. So I do think that will become, that's coming like really, really fast. And it's just going to, you know, that's going to be regulated before any sort of really legitimate central bank digital currency. Yet, if they could pull it off, yeah, it would simply be like it's a digital form of cash, that cash that they create on their balance sheet. Yet they can sort of control it more digitally, close you out if they don't like what you're spending on, all those things that we fear, like with the Orwellian state. But I'm skeptical. I'm, you know, again, not being a technologist myself, I'm very skeptical that they can pull off. I mean, we have these theories like checks in, again, Europe is way past this with SEPA, which was a goodwill project, which actually worked pretty well between European nations. But, you know, US is awash in checks still, as I just told you, the stimulus checks.
The check is a like a 300-year-old invention. I mean, and we still are using it like in the digital age. So I think that there's plenty of research. Like checks could go on for like 30 more years in some form in the U.S. So if we're talking about like checks going on, like how are they going to get a central bank digital currency? I don't know. That's just me. I'm very skeptical. Maybe a country like China, which is like just going to batten it down and like, you know, it's a separate economy, really hardcore, try to engineer it and not let anybody in somehow, even though it's digital, like behind their firewall, whatever. Maybe they can pull off something. But I am skeptical about the success of CBDCs.
Yeah, I really liked your mentioning that there could be software hacks. I didn't think about this before. But I would be like super excited if these things happen. Yeah. Rather looking at this from an economic perspective, that more and more people realize now that our fiat money system is actually a Ponzi scheme, and the CBDCs are as well. And the money only has a value because people attribute value to this money. And if they know that they can print infinitely, then actually it doesn't have value. So I would give the fiat money no value from this point of view, but I do give it value right now because others give fiat value and I can use it for buying goods and paying my rent right now. But I see that this will change more and more. People just realize that this is not a sound monetary system, and we are becoming more, the Bitcoiners get more, they're spreading the word. So if they introduce the central bank digital currencies, I think they could be there for maybe months, years, but they will eventually collapse when enough people again realize that it's just not a sound money, and then they will go to another system.
Yeah, the only thing that they have at the end of the day to enforce it, to enforce that fiat, that decree, is the legal, you know, legal tender laws, specifically with money. But then, you know, as many Austrian libertarian philosophers go, I mean, the farther back you go, I mean, just it's the government license. I mean, that's the problem. Like, only central banks are the ones with the monopoly to print some sort of media that can circulate as money. And as a lot of free market economists who I really enjoy, like Dr. Selgin, Dr. White, Kevin Dowd, I mean, there's plenty of examples where there need not have been a central bank or government interference for a monetary system to work. Can totally work without that. Bitcoin was an invention outside of the government. And as you said, more and more people are getting involved. And I think that the history is pretty clear, right? When there's something good, there's an invention that's good, the government will try to take it over, to co-opt it. They usually make it slow. They turn it into like a utility. You know, I mean, everybody needs it. Everybody should have some piece of it. And they try to just make it something where, you know, everybody has access. But that usually comes at the expense of reliability and soundness and speed and quality and price. If not more nefarious things like special interests and some crony capitalism and people, you know, getting mixed up with the wrong characters behind the scenes in government. So, and then of course you can go even farther. I mean, like, you know, they are the ones that, you know, if you don't pay your taxes, you know, you don't want to know what happens to you when you don't pay your taxes. You have to pay your taxes. So, they're going to give it all they got. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, the monetary system is actually a monetary system without a central authority is actually much better, because what are they doing right now? These central banks, they're artificially reducing the interest rates, even to negative interest rates, which from a human action, praxeological kind of viewpoint does not make sense. It's not logical. And apart from that, this is the reason why we have boom and bust cycles, why we have so much misallocation of resources, why we have so incredible high inflation that the assets rise so incredible that especially young people are
reliability and soundness and speed and quality and price, if not more nefarious things like special interests and some crony capitalism and people, you know, getting mixed up with the wrong characters behind the scenes in government. So, and then of course you can go even farther. I mean, like, you know, they are the ones that, you know, if you don't pay your taxes, you know, you don't want to know what happens to you when you don't pay your taxes. You have to pay your taxes. So they're going to give it all they got. That's for sure.
All right. I got kicked out for the last 2 minutes or so. Can you guys still hear me?
It's not logical. And apart from that, this is the reason why we have boom and bust cycles, why we have so much misallocation of resources, why we have so incredible high inflation that the assets rise so incredible that especially young people are very frustrated because they cannot buy a house ever, and they are kind of stuck in the system, and the gap between rich and poor increases, the whole system becomes more unstable. And so another monetary system would solve all the problems, although they say that printing more money would solve the problem of a malworking economy, which is just untrue. It's just some crazy theory that was put in place to justify their means. And what they're doing is they're essentially taking over the economies, controlling and steering the economy, and like literally buying up assets with money printed out of thin air. I mean, that's criminal. They're doing this as their whole system, which we are all using. It's just beyond.
Yeah. And as Milton Friedman said, and I like Milton Friedman for some stuff. I know a lot of Austrians don't like him. I'm not a fan of the monetarist like ideology, but he was correct when he said, you know, that there will, when you have government involved, you will always have the unholy alliance of the do-gooders on the one side and the special interests on the other. And as I was alluding to, and I think you mentioned, you know, are alluding to as well, you know, that's where you get this malaise, this crony capitalism, this inefficiency, and in some cases just downright immoral behavior. Whereas if you were a private actor in the market providing some service, whether it be money or anything, I mean, and you failed to provide it, or you were fraudulent, you know, you would just be quickly pushed out of the market, whereas we just cannot push them out of the market. And That's the world we're in.
They actually have the monopoly on fraud as well. And yeah. Hans Hoppe was saying this so nicely, that when you have this democracy, you have the special interests, the lobbyists that come, and everyone wants to get as much from the pie, from this redistribution pie. And then this is forced on the rest. And actually what we see is that we have these lobbyists working together with the politicians. And I mean, this is also already like mainstream. Also the mainstream people know that. And what is actually also working behind the scenes is that this whole construct is working together with the financial system to get cheap money to do their means. And this is also more and more coming more visible right now. For example, I mean, bonds are bought from Siemens, Allianz, and all the big corporations, they profit. But, you know, the small shop next door cannot profit from super cheap debt. So it's always the big business that is profiting from all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's mind-boggling. And we're seeing it with COVID. I mean, only essential items can be sold, or non, you know, items that aren't competing with other, you know, mom and pop shops or whatever. It's at the worst possible time to regulate such a thing. And, you know, it only hurts the consumer.
Yeah. And the chain reaction of damages, you know, collateral damages, the second, third degree effects, the 800, I think there are 800,000 zombie companies in Germany. I think Dr. Markus Krall said that.
Wow.
There are 800,000, like, you know, sort more like bankrupt companies in Germany. You know, I mean, it's like a quarter of all companies in it. So I don't know what's going to come up.
Like, you have like a study on that? I would be interested.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a study, I'll send you that, definitely. But, you know, we did like really, the guy's one of the greatest experts, Dr. Krall. I mean, he's a gold bug, but, you know, we love him for his work. Mm-hmm. He's really great. He's Austrian economist, like Dr. Thorsten Pollett also. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, I got kicked out from Zoom. I don't know. I even changed my location with 300 megabits, but still, you know, I got kicked out. So anyway, I got to really listen to that, the few minutes that I got kicked out. But what if, you know, still going back to Bitcoin, I think it's so astonishing which you elaborated in your Twitter thread. It's like the 10th largest money ex gold and silver, but with gold and silver, it's 12th, 12th
one rank. One spot up now after this price boom.
Yeah.
Is past Russia.
That's amazing.
Right about now, right about this level, I think, I'm pretty sure it's at Canada. Canada is crazy things. They've gone really up and down with their balance sheet, but I think it's right about 18K where Canada sits at the moment. you know, keep, yeah, it's about 18K. So amazing. We'll see. Now, I only count those at month end, so we'll see at next quarter where Bitcoin sort of stands. But yeah, it's incredible, and it's catching on. I saw a girl from Game of Thrones. Did you see that, Macy Williams? She put out a poll: should I buy Bitcoin or not? And it's a huge poll. I mean, it's massive. Like you know, because she's got like millions of followers. And
that's a wonderful meme.
It was 47% yes, 53% no. Very interesting. Just massive for the attention to Bitcoin. Like, someone, so really mainstream, you know, young girl, should she invest in her financial future a little bit in Bitcoin? And she after the poll, she's like, thanks for the support. I bought some anyway or something. Even though 47% only yes. And so it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. It's unfortunate though, during this time, as you say, like,
yeah,
I really don't like, and I never liked the bent that some people go with, like, you know, it's, none of us want like financial collapse to bring about, you know, the thing that we believe. And unfortunately, that's just how it seems to happen.
Well, it's not going to be frictionless. I mean, that's what we know for sure. But with, you know, we want it, we wish it to be as smooth and frictionless as possible. So yeah, you know, I mean, besides the number go up technology and this whole FOMOing, it is, I mean, I see, fortunately, it's really good news that so many, even amongst the, you know, macro investors, you know, even one of the richest billionaires in Mexico got, like, I think if it's true, like 10% of its net assets in Bitcoin now, or is, you know, so it's good that, you know, the comprehension is kicking in a lot of, you know, on every level, like what Bitcoin really means, you know, out of necessity.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I have one more question. It was on your tweet 51. Sure. That you were mentioning the silver price, because many say, yeah, that silver is actually undervalued. And you mentioned a mean how to say that it's actually not overvalued. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on this. So I think it started in the 49 and then ended at the 51. That would be awesome.
Yeah, sure. So I tried to do it, you know, subtly, whatever. I mean, I took on a little bit of some gold bugs there. I took on some silver bugs. the one thing, I'll start with gold, actually. I know you asked about silver, but the one thing that gold bugs like to say is they like to say that if you take out all of the, you know, industrial uses of silver, which is indeed, a lot. It's over 50%. You take out all the industrial usage of silver, both on the stock side and on the flow side. Actually, on the, I should say, only on the stock side, you will get to a very, very low stock to flow for silver, right? Something like 3 or 4. And I understand that. I understand what they're doing. But what they are doing is, yes, discounting the whole stock of silver way down, taking out all the industrial uses of silver, all in wires and electronics and everything. But they're also taking out the silverware and the jewelry. They're taking out everything, and they're leaving it only with bullion, which admittedly is a very small portion of silver bullion in the world, coins and bars. There's a few central banks that still hold it, very small. And then just private silver. You know, silver you can buy with gold money or whatever, silver eagles. And then take that full flow. They take the full flow, the full annual production of silver, all right? So a very small stock and a very small discounted stock with the full flow, which goes into not just bullion, but into industrial, into silverware, into other things. And they say, okay, well, silver's not very good as a hedge or investment because it's got a stock to flow of 3. And then they always, in the same breath, quote the gold stock to flow of 60, which is, it's not, in my complete understanding, I get this data from Nick Laird. He's an expert in the gold and silver business. He knows all the people. He publishes this data. I purchased it from him. It's not 60. It's like 55. That's the number. But anyway, so in the same breath, gold bugs will say silver is a stock to flow of 3, but gold is 55. But what they're doing in that comparison is not discounting out all of the industrial usage of gold and all of the jewelry in gold, because there's a huge portion of the gold stock that's in jewelry. It is true that the gold bullion, coins and bars, proportionally is more than silver. It's like maybe 30% for gold and like 3% for silver. I'm not sure exactly on those numbers, but it's very, you know, it's true that there's more percentage-wise, more coins and bars, more bullion for gold and silver. But you got to be apples to apples. So that was that slide 48, if you want to look at that, where I have all these different stocks and flows. Like, I can give you a stock to flow of 3 for silver if you want, but if you're going to say that silver stock to flow is 3, you better quote that comparable one for gold, and that is 21. It's 21. So take out, if you're going to discount everything, all the industrial, all the silverware, take everything out but bullion, do the same thing for gold, and you're going to get a different number. So you can play around with all those numbers, and that's
so. Let me clarify that, Matthew. Yeah. So this whole stock to flow ratio of gold that you always even Safin and Amuz in his book of 62 or 58 or approximately 60 wouldn't that be
55? But yeah,
okay.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
So that would mean that's not correct then.
I have it on my phone here, you know, but if you look at that slide 48, you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different ways to calculate okay, stock gotcha, flow. Gotcha. So one is, you know, all time. One is discount industrial usage, right? Which is much different, much more no doubt, take out from silver than gold. Next one is discount jewelry. That's fine. I just did one over time and then one over a year. But yeah, basically all time, take out industrial, take out jewelry. Those are the differences. And you can do them for either. You can get, but my point was, you always hear, and this is not just Bitcoin bugs. Yes, I have heard Safin does this. You know, he's been on our show. It's fine. I know that he has a soft spot for gold, but many people do that in the gold industry. It's not just him. So my point is, if you're going to quote silver with a stock to flow of 3 or 4, it's closer to 4 as I calculate it, then you better in the same breath note that gold's 21 in that analysis.
Interesting.
That's apples to apples comparison. Okay. So that's gold. So that was my beef with gold bugs. Now with silver, as you mentioned, Stephanie, that for years we've heard that silver, you know, because gold price relative to silver is like 100x, you know, it's 80x now or something, but it's always been like massive discrepancy in the last 20 years. And this has particularly been a meme for the last 10 years, and that silver bugs are like, well, it's got to go back to its pre, you know, it's historical ratio. Like the mining ratio is like 9, the natural ratio is like 17, like the actual crustal ratio relatively. I think the, you know, those, just the Roman ratio might've been like 15. So whatever, 12, 9, you know, it's 80. Now, if you look at the price, it's 80. So say if, you know, it's going to go back to like 16, that at least means they, you know, divide those two ratios. That at least has got to be a 5x bump in silver relative to gold. So if gold's going to, this was also pre-Bitcoin, so a lot of like gold bugs were doing this. But like if the monetary system is going to explode, if gold is going to explode in price because of it, silver's going to do 5 times better or 10 times better because it's way undervalued relative to gold based on the price. However, the simple thing that those silver bugs are ignoring, and again, this is market. I don't know what the market will do, but I'm just saying, let's hold the 16 to 1. I think the 16 to 1 was the number I used. Let's hold that number as gospel, right? 16 to 1 should be the ratio, not 80 to 1, right? But let's hold 16 to 1 as the ratio. Well, in reality, we're even below that right now because you're not looking at the actual cap, the market cap of silver, the value. You can't just look at price because price is just on one individual unit. But let's look at the actual, all the supply that's out there in the world today. And I think that I'm just to read what I quoted, right? So the all time, if we can do two numbers here, all time today, relatively, the value of gold in the world is about $11.7 trillion. Mm-hmm. Silver is 1.3. So that's a ratio of 9. So if you want to go to back to that ratio of, that's the, that is actually, it's always been that way. That's called the mining ratio. It's a ratio of 9. So we're already there, first of all. I mean, forget the price of being 80x, 100x, right? That you see the stocks, the supplos, the stocks are at a ratio of 9. So if you want to get to that price ratio of like 15 or 16, I think the number that I used was 16, that ratio, you got to actually decrease the silver price. You got to decrease it. Silver would have to fall. You'd have to get, you know, again, you hold gold constant. You have to hold gold constant to do this, right? Mm-hmm. The gospel, presumably that the gospel is the ratio. So if gold is 11.7 and that's a ratio of 9, well, if you want to get to a ratio of 16, holding gold constant, you got to decrease the market cap of all time silver to get to a ratio of 16. Does that make sense? So you have to, might have botched my explanation of that a little bit at the end, but basically we're already there. Like, it's just a different lens, right? All of the, what has been said for 10 years by silver bugs of the silver's way undervalued compared to gold because it's, you know, gold is 80 times more expensive in price. They're not looking at the underlying supply that's out there. Mm-hmm. In the world, you got to multiply the price by the units, and then the picture becomes much clearer. And that's the ratio we should do. So you could do it the all time, or you could even take away the industrial, which I did. And so if you take away the industrial, then you're about $10 trillion in gold. Mm-hmm. And 0.7 trillion, 700 billion in silver. And if you do that math, 10 divided by 0.7, right? You're already basically at 16. Again, just assuming 16 is the gospel number. So you like, there's a minus 5% move in price, still down. So silver, remarkably, is close to the historical ratios of whatever you want to say, 9, 12, 15, 16. It's right at it. You can't look at the price difference of $2,000 an ounce versus $20 in silver, which is not, I know that's 100x difference. You can't look at the differences in price. You have to actually look at all of the stock together to try to understand what those ratios mean. And again, I'm not saying that it stays there. I'm not saying that like next week the ratio might bounce. Of course, only the market knows that, but it's a little calling out of some gold and silver bug treatment that's typically given. And again, and not because I have no problem with gold. I have no problem with silver. It's not that I want to try to cheerlead for one or the other. I like them all and I like Bitcoin, But it's just interesting where people like to kind of harp on certain pieces of data with not really providing the full picture was my point there. And I think I probably talked way too long on that answer, but sorry.
No, fascinating. So let's just hold on for a second here. So the market capitalization of Bitcoin right now is nothing. I mean, it's like a drop on a hot stone, like $350 billion. Do you see like a pivotal point, like a critical tipping point where it could go like by order of magnitude and exceed even the market, I don't know what you call it, market capitalization of gold of 10 trillion? And what would happen then? Because that could happen really fast.
Your guys' guess is as good as mine. But I think what is happening, those booms, and then, you know, I don't want to say busts, right? But these booms and then sort of cooling off periods. No one knows what was really happening with gold and silver, right? I mean, when they were sort of becoming monetized, becoming commoditized, we don't really have data on that. We do for Bitcoin. It's very interesting, right? I mean, we have just, you know, and I don't know if it's a function of like every 4 years, you just have 16-year-olds that want to spend mommy and daddy's money. And they sort of see, you know, it's just a function of 16-year-olds every 4 years sort of kind of coming into the financial world and knowing that Bitcoin is so much more logical and rational than even gold and silver, even though I have no problem with gold and silver. I don't know if that's the reason, but it seems to be every 3 or 4 years that we have these booms. So, and they're certainly exponential, right? I mean, it was nothing for 10 years. And then Bitcoin passed like virtually every currency in the world in 2017. I mean, it's actually because Canada was lower in 2017 when that peak happened at 20,000. And even though there was less Bitcoins around in 2017, it was at 20,000, the market cap, it did peak at about 9. So we're back at 9, although Russia is the one below, Canada's above. We're including gold and silver, we're 11. Sorry, I shouldn't say too many numbers. Let's just count fiat, right? Bitcoin was at 9. It ranked number 9 in 2017 at the peak. It just blew past all of them. And then it stayed there, basically fell back down a little bit, but stayed at that number now for the last 3 years. So again, I mean, I don't predicting supply and demand is difficult and amidst the financial crisis or a global pandemic, of course, but it seems that the growth of such an asset requires an exponential sort of boom because of a variety of factors. And that seems what it does. Do I think that it will blow past like gold in one run? Probably, you know, absolutely not. But I do think, you know, if you see it blow past 20,000 and then go to like 100,000, maybe 200,000. Mm-hmm. Certainly could do that. It's still going to be below the top four currencies is that at that number. Let me just quickly get the pound. What's the pound? That's a good one. So the pound is 60K. The pound is 60K. So once it blows past the pound at 60K, there's only the top four currencies left. And I don't think it will hit them during this run at all. It'd have to be, you know, somewhere around 250,000. Okay. So I think maybe it gets somewhere up there close, but then I think it pulls back. Again, not financial advice. I'm just talking here, but based on these past booms and then sort of cooling off periods, I don't see why, it's past, you know, the South Korean won, the Russian ruble, why it can't just blow past the loonie, the Swiss franc or the British pound and the Indian rupee as well while it's doing it. And by the way, it would pass silver as we've talked about. That 36K, that's available silver. That's all the silver in the world, including silverware, including jewelry, including bullion, because that's all the liquid silver, at least as I believe you should measure it. So yeah, only after you get above 60K, the only thing that remains are the top four currencies and gold. So I definitely think, I think it'll make a run here this next time, but I don't know. Who knows? I mean, maybe it blows up to 250, 300 in the next run and then cools back, but.
By that time, this is always my question. It's like we're constantly thinking, comparing, denominating in fiat. By that time, when it goes to whatever amount, like 200, 300, 500,000. Are we really going to compare that in fiat? Are we really going to think, or are we like measuring like as a unit account in satoshis? Because yeah, it's the purchasing power, you know, that's going to come.
I put that actually in the notes, is that I think as that is that multiplier, the notes of my table, as that multiplier goes towards one of basically the, you know, the value of Bitcoin, instead of being like 99x smaller than fiat, but if it goes to basically one, yeah, I don't see why we wouldn't at least start to have other people understand things in the unit of Satoshi or the unit of a BTC for sure. I think that's a great point. And I think that has to happen in the next 10 years, but these are glacial things. These definitely are slow. I think that has to happen.
All right. Matthew, I really love that talk. We could talk with you, you know, for hours, and Stephanie, I'm sure you too. So Matthew, any final thoughts? Or I'm really looking forward for your next report, and been listening to your interviews lately. It's mind-blowing. So any final thoughts, or where people can find you?
No. Well, actually one more, sorry. You put it in my head there when you were talking about Satoshis. Another thing, which is, again, contrary to like a subjective value and a lot of Austrian theories, a lot of people like to use the phrase like money is a measuring stick. And this is also what I'm not trying to do here. The idea, like you said, of like the dollar is a measuring, is kind of a measuring stick, sorry, the unit of account that we use globally today, dollars reserve currency, whatever we use that term. But really, it's just one way to kind of set the stage. Like I could do this in Japanese yen, I could do it in you know, Chinese yuan. It's gonna mean different things to different people at different times. I could do it in gold ounces. So I can't do it in Bitcoin though, because actually it wouldn't make sense, right? You'd have to have like, you'd have some number over 21 million. So that's an interesting thing. It's only gonna make sense, as you said, once that number is at one. Once it's at one, the ratio is at one, then you could start to do it, because there's actually so many units of base money more than Bitcoin. You can't actually do it in Bitcoin yet. It wouldn't make sense. But the point is that money is measuring stick is a term. Fernando and I talk about that a lot. We've heard some people make it at like some Bitcoin conferences, like, you know, comparing different things. It's a subtle thing, but like, you know, goods can only be compared ordinally at any time by the individual actor, right? It's like you're at the baker, you want the loaf of bread more than you want the euros. The baker wants the euros more than the loaf of bread. I can make a panel of prices and talk about bread, but if the bread goes bad, if it expires, like what does matter? You know, like, and there's no doubt there's a lot of that going on in this chart. Like I'm doing my best to try to be like consistent. And like, you know, we talked about these different stock to flows, but, there is actually no concept of money as a measuring stick. Like I'm trying to measure the supply, show of the landscape, lay of the land, but it is actually impossible to measure something like this, like globally, as far as like what it means to anybody. And this goes back to your question about like, is it the booms and busts? What can we expect? You know, you get a couple more Michael Saylors, you know, coming public, and it's like what nobody expected, right?
Yeah. So
it's just, that's a really important, I think, Austrian point is like that's a contrary to Austrian economics and to subjective values to say, it's like, you know, it's like Thomas DiLorenzo. I really like him. He used to say this, you know, it's like economists, like political economists today that are hired by government agencies, they think that they can, you know, it's like a Frankenstein thing, right? They think they can shock the economy back into life. They think they can, you know, twitch and use a tool here, like the Frankenstein thing. That is a tool. And it's the same thing with money as a measuring stick. Like you think you know exactly how long the ruler should be and which tools to use. And it's just, the economy does not work like that. It's completely flies in the face of subjective value, where, you know, that bread could go stale. I mean, or the person could, you know, you cannot. Everything can only be done ordinally between two market actors. And that happens an infinite amount of times a day. So that's just a point. Like, I'm not saying I know everything about the value of Bitcoin with this, you know, with this exercise. It's a way of showing the landscape in this sort of unit account that we understand, but it is a subtle point. Like people in Japan and China, you know, we're in Europe, US here, kind of Western, like we look at it differently than people in Latin America. You know, if gold comes down from space, we're all going to look at it gold very differently from asteroids. So yeah, I'll stop talking there. Sorry. I think that kind of wraps up though, what you were saying about if and when and how fast this can happen, because it can happen a lot faster than I think anybody thinks. And as Murray Rothbard was saying for years and years, this is finally coming true. Like there is no limit to the amount of things that the central banks can buy either. We always thought that it was only government bonds. Now they're buying they're buying corporate bonds. The Bank of Japan and the Bank of Switzerland, they've bought stocks. There's no doubt. I mean, there's no reason why. There are all legal reasons, but they're going to find a way to get around them. There's no reason why the U.S. Federal Reserve could not buy stocks and enter the stock market either. So there's no limit on the money that they can print.
So in March, the Federal Reserve was buying up ETFs. So because, you know, the Standard & Poor's went down sharply. And on the day it went up, this was the day where the central bank announced that they're buying up these ETF bundles and stabilize the market or actually bail out the investors. I have it in my article as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's corporate bond ETFs, right? As I understand. I don't think there's actually any full equity yet, but it could easily come. And the Bank of Switzerland owns Facebook. The Bank of Japan owns Facebook. That's with printed money. That's with money that's just printed. They own pieces of those companies. So
They have those special, what is it called? Special vehicle or a report?
Yeah.
So through that mechanism, they could literally like buy anything, like even equities or anything.
But even don't think about all like the complicated structure they use. Mm-hmm. Murray Rothbard wrote this, and he wrote this in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, and it's finally really coming true. And they did it in 2008 buying real estate too, indirectly. They bought mortgage-backed securities, which were government-sponsored mortgage-backed securities. It wasn't like kind of directly free market, but still they bought them because they were junk and no one wanted to have them and they had to bail out the banks. But Murray Rothbard wrote this specifically. He's like, all that they need to do is buy assets. And this is a very true fact that as long as they have the monopoly power, they just need to buy assets. We think that it's only the government bond, but as is shown, you know, and Stephanie talked about, like it can be corporate bonds, it can be stocks, and it can be Bitcoin as well. It can be Bitcoin. So there's plenty of things that I think that can and probably will happen faster than we expect. So sorry, I get on these tangents, but
no, it's super overdue to talk about this. So Matthew, so thank you so much. I can only recommend my listeners to follow you on Twitter. That's crypto_voices. Anything that people can follow you? I mean, I also love the podcast you do with Fernando. A lot of them are in Spanish, unfortunately.
Fernando's doing a lot more these days on his Portuguese show down in Brazil, Portuguese language down in Brazil. He comes on every once in a while. I'm doing this monetary base stuff a lot as well. But the podcast is there. The monetary base exhibit that we talked about is there. CryptoVoices.com. You can also find it at basemoney.world. There will be more to come in the future as time allows, I guess. So
great. So super. So Stephanie, thanks so much for your excellent questions and your cool moderation. Any final thoughts or input?
Actually, we discussed everything great length. That was awesome. Thank you so much for coming. And I think it was super nice to really go into more detail and explain your view on how you went into this whole thing, that you are looking at changes in the monetary base and not measurings in some kind of US dollar, because we have to go beyond this whole thinking, okay, this would be fixed, the measurements, that this one currency would be fixed and this is our unit of account. Yeah. And also what Austrian economics and Mises said with human action and how our price is actually coming. So when I'm buying something, as you said, it's a subjective value. I prefer to have the good instead of the money. And I give the money a certain valuation and the goods a certain valuation. Everything is objective and everything is up to change. And this is also something we discuss right now. Right now, we are in a situation where everything can change very radically. And it also very much depends on what the people think, what are their preferences, how they see the world. And there's, I think we cannot really imagine right now where we're going to, because there are like so many opportunities and it will be quite interesting.
Yeah, completely agree.
All right, Matthew, thank you so much again. I'm really grateful for your work. You're serving humanity, enhancing the comprehension and clarifying a lot of misconceptions. So thank you a lot.
Calculate stuff.
And hopefully we can repeat this sometime in the next year together.
Sure.
Okay.
Hey, Ivan, nice to meet you, Stephanie. Nice. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Bye, Matthew. Okay, Stephanie, let's do a quick wrap up, or I want to know your thoughts and really mind blowing. I think it's going to help a lot of people who also have misconceptions about silver, gold, the relative absolute scarcity, the stock to flow ratio. What did you think?
Yeah, cool that you're mentioning right now, because this is also what I had in mind first, that he's really making everything clear, like from all perspectives, looking at different monetary systems like the fiat system, Bitcoin, gold, silver. And he's like checking out where are the problems in the calculation, why you have to compare them with the different kind of metrics. And he brought this all up to the surface. And I think that's super great. And also, yeah, as I said already, taking this different vantage point on looking at changes in the money supply instead of the prices of goods or the valuation in the other money again, because what is the base money or what is the reserve currency? It might change. So I really like this approach. It's fascinating.
Exactly. Yeah. And he articulates in the language combined with the graphs, like on his Twitter thread. It's that really, I think every child can understand like what he's talking about, because usually, it's like wrapped or packaged into very like sophisticated language, but it clarifies a lot. So really grateful for his work. And if you have any final thoughts, we can wrap this up. And thank you so much, Stephanie, for your co-moderation, for your excellent input. I can only again recommend also my listeners to check your articles on medium.com/Stephanie. What's your Medium name, because it's different from your Twitter handle?
Vian or Fonyan, I don't know, but
okay, sure, I'll put it in the show notes. All right.
Medium, and then I find this. My last thought. So what I was thinking, okay, central banks are now buying Bitcoin with their fake fiat money out of, trying to create the money out of thin air. And I was like, no, somehow on the one side, it's good because there's more adoption, then they don't ban it, or hopefully. But on the other side, we really need to bring this idea to the world, what Bitcoin is and what the fiat system is, so that we can have a change to the better system where they cannot extract our wealth by printing or using the money out of thin air to buy valuable assets such as Bitcoin, gold, or real estate. Go, everyone who listens, go out, educate the people, so that we have also the smoothest shift as possible. So I do expect that it will be quite some turmoil. I mean, we're having it right now already, but the financial economic crash is in front of us. And then the people will realize, oh, okay, this money, maybe it's hyperinflating and it's not what I expected it to be. And this will be quite shocking, I expect. So the more people notice, the earlier, the better. So this is just what I can recommend. Tell your friends, but don't be too pushy, because that doesn't work as well.
No, sow the seeds. And again, I just want to, final conclusion, concluding thought is that, again, it's about absolute scarcity of Bitcoin, 21 million. It doesn't matter now how many million of coins have been lost. It just really doesn't matter. And there are 2,500 billionaires in the world and approximately 48 million millionaires in the whole world. So just, you can intuitively calculate for yourself, like how much, for let's say 7.8 or 8 billion people can be allocated. If we just calculate on the numbers, based on the numbers. So yeah, stack sats, take care of your security and privacy. And I think it's all about, you know, the cat is out of the bag, and if people understand the power of purchasing power, you know, the purchasing power in the, you know, foreseeable future, that's why, you know, so many people are now getting it, you know, even the macro world and investor world and institutional and ultra net rich people and individuals, they're getting it. So it really makes me happy.
Yeah, we can create a wonderful future for everyone, to be honest, yeah, when we of these central authorities that actually extract wealth out of us, put us in poverty, which is all a means so we don't question the whole system and legitimize it. If we get rid of all these things, we can build a better future for everyone on humane values, you know, where there's no coercion. So I think the opportunities we have for the future are not really imaginable for so many. And I really hope that we will go to this transition the smoothest as possible and as soon as possible, because it's really a time. There's so much suffering and poverty to make a change.
Yeah, it's really beyond imagination, beyond words, to be honest with you. If I observe everything what's going on, the state, the governments, the central banks, I mean, let alone they're above the law, but just understanding that they have lost and they have never had a legitimacy. And it's what do you call it? You just said it previously. It's criminal, and it's systematic theft. They have a monopoly on violence, aggression, on theft. And I think people, it's really time to wake up. And you know, when you know, the crimes are becoming so heinous and so horrendous, you know, people always talk about Nazi regime, you know, or whatever. I mean, when you know, things have become so unjust, then it's our moral and, you know, ethical, not only for ourselves, but for posterity, to resist, to defy, and to, yeah. And I mean, we're 8 billion people, for Christ's sake. It's got to be possible, you know. I mean, when is, like, the finishing point, like, you know, when, how much are we going to endure, or, you know, or is it already like 5 minutes past 12? This is a question I'm asking myself nowadays, you know, because of the centralized power. It is this control obsessed, this power that's, you know, just blowing up, and it, I don't know, it's, I don't have no words for that. Just think about that, you know, to my listeners. Yeah. All right, Stephanie. Happy to talk to you again soon, and have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. It was nice to see you. Bye-bye.
Bye, Stephanie.